Yes, this seminar is called Imagining the Buddha, and we're going to be trying over the next few weeks, 4 weeks, to approach the Buddha, to approach the Buddha in our imagination, and also through, in a way, hearing his words. We're trying to, in a way, use our imaginations to get as close as we can to the actual experience of being with the Buddha, what it would have been like to be around at the time that the Buddha was walking around in northern India 2,500 years ago. And one way that we can do that is by studying the words that he spoke, or as close to the words that he spoke that we are able to get to. Another way is the way that we've just been doing in our meditation, where we just use our imaginations to evoke and feel his presence and see what response we have. And that's a very, very powerful way of doing that. Even walking into the shrine room, we began by saluting the shrine. In a certain sense, what we're trying to do is imagine the Buddha. When we salute the shrine, we're trying to imagine that this shrine is the Buddha, and how would it be to salute the Buddha? How would it be to pay reverence to the Buddha? We're using our imaginations to try and get close to the experience of the Buddha. And as Buddhists, if you consider yourself a Buddhist, that's essential to our practice, is to imagine the Buddha and to make that imaginative experience a reality in our lives, so that it actually affects our lives, so that it affects and changes us. So it's not just a sort of fantasy game, it's a practice. It's a practice so that we can move closer to the Buddha, so that we can go for refuge to the Buddha. In traditional language, we're trying to deepen our going for refuge to the Buddha. And in order to go for refuge to the Buddha, we have to have a sense of who the Buddha is. Who the Buddha is, and what the qualities of the Buddha are, so that we can make them the guiding principle of our lives. So we have to have clarity about that. So what we're going to do is explore in these 4 weeks a text called the Tiratnavandana, which is a traditional text that's chanted all over the Buddhist world in Pali, in the language that's very close to the language the Buddha would have spoken, and is also the language in which the earliest scriptures of Buddhism have come down to us, have been preserved in. So we've got these texts in Pali that come as close to the words that the Buddha would have spoken. And in this particular text, the Tiratnavandana, there are certain sections, there are three sections that occur again and again in the Pali Canon, throughout the Pali Canon. There are some words here embedded in the Tiratnavandana that occur again and again in the Pali Canon, and they're words of the Buddha. They're words of the Buddha. So by exploring this text, we're going to explore something very fundamental. And I'm going to base this exploration on some talks that Subhuti gave recently on a retreat when he was down here just a few months ago. So he gave these talks, which were available, by the way, on Free Buddhist Audio. So if you want to hear the actual talks and listen to Subhuti rather than my attempts at summarising Subhuti, then do listen to them there. If you just search for Tiratna on Free Buddhist Audio, you'll hear, well, five talks will come up, and you can listen to them. I've been listening to them, or some of them today, and they're really worth listening to. Even if you're able to attend the seminar, I'd recommend you listening to Subhuti's talks, because, I'm not Subhuti, and also he had more time to go into depth than we're going to have in the course of these 4 evenings. So we're going to be looking at this text, And in a few moments, I'll ask the team to hand you a copy of the text, and then we're going to go through it over the next 4 weeks. And we'll also chant the text, or portions of the text. We'll do some of that this evening and over the subsequent weeks. But I want to say something about why this text is so central, why these words contained in the Tirat Navandana are so central to what it is to be a Buddhist, to what it is to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So, first of all, the Tirat Navandana, Tiratna means the three jewels, the three jewels. Ratna is jewel, T is three in Pali. Tiratna is three jewels. And Vandana is salutation. It's paying homage, reverence to the three jewels. So this text is a salutation, a homage to the three jewels. A salutation to the three jewels. And there's a section on each of the three jewels in the text, which you'll see when I hand you the text. And part of that section, part of each section on each of the three jewels, contains these words that occur, as I say, again and again in the Pali Canon. And I just want to refer to one place that they occur in the Pali Canon. And this, again, comes from something that Subhuti explored. So there's a sutta called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is a sutta that talks about the last days of the Buddha on earth, in this life, as it were. The last days of the Buddha. So he's an old man, he's a man of 80, he is a dying man, and he knows that he's dying. And in the Parinibbana Sutta, you are told the story of him wandering across northern India, revisiting all the places that he has spent so many decades teaching, revisiting, as Subhuti says, all his centres, if you like, and travelling with a whole company of monks, going from place on to place on foot, this old sick man, doing, as it were, a final tour of teaching to try and make sure that his followers understand unequivocally what his teaching is, and to answer any last questions and questions of doubts or clarification that they might have. And he goes from place to place to place in this sutta, accompanied by Ananda and these other monks, but Ananda as his very, very loyal and faithful disciple and companion. And again and again, in this last tour, the Buddha emphasizes the threefold path. Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, ethics, meditation, wisdom. In a way, the threefold path is one of the simplest formulations of the Buddhist path that you can have. Later Buddhism, even the Buddhism of the Buddha's time, had more elaborate teachings. You can't get more simple than sila, samadhi, prajna, ethics, meditation, wisdom. Meditation founded on an ethical practice, and then reflection leading to wisdom founded on a mind that's purified through meditation and through ethics. Ethics, meditation, and wisdom, sila, samadhi, prajna, he talks about this again and again and again. It's as if he's saying, look, that's all you need to know. This is the essence of my teaching. This is the path. Follow the path. Follow the path. And in the sutta, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he arrives at a place, I think it's called Nardika. And the sutta says that he stays in Nardika in a brick house. So it must have been worthy or noteworthy that there was this house made of bricks, and the Buddha stayed in this brick house. And there are all these people around him, and Ananda, one of Ananda's roles was to welcome people who wanted to see the Buddha. He would be the welcoming sort of, he's in a way a sort of gatekeeper, but actually that's to not do Ananda justice, because Ananda is incredibly warm and friendly and approachable. It's said that everybody likes Ananda, and he really wants to help people, and he wants people to see the Buddha. He really wants to help people. So it's said that whether there were monks or nuns or laymen or laywomen, they all really liked Ananda. And so they all approach Ananda, and people are asking Ananda to ask the Buddha what happened to various practitioners, various monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen who had died. Because it's the Buddha is able to see what their spiritual attainment was before they died, what level of attainment had they reached, and also, therefore, what sort of birth they were going to have. So all these people are asking Ananda to ask the Buddha what level these people who have died had reached. And the Buddha answers, and he says, so-and-so was a stream entrant, so-and-so was an arahant before they died, they became an arahant, so-and-so was a once-returner, so-and-so was a non-returner, and there's lots of them, there's lots of them, there's a whole heap of them. And Subhuti makes the point that it's striking how many people had attained to some degree of transcendental insight in the Buddha's own lifetime. How many of them had done that? How many had become even fully enlightened beings? It's really striking when you read the Pali Canon. There's name after name after name of people, men and women. And also what's interesting is many of these people who had attained insight aren't monks or nuns. They're laymen or laywomen. Any kind of notion that might have later got spread in Buddhism that you had to be a monk or a nun in order to really make progress on the path isn't true according to these early Buddhist texts. You could be a monk or a nun, obviously, but you could also be a lay disciple, a man or woman lay disciple, and reach these transcendental attainments. Anyway, there's a whole list of names in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta of people who have attained some things. And then the Buddha says to Ananda, look, Ananda, if you continue asking me every time somebody has died, or if you hear of somebody who's died, what level of attainment they'd reached before they died, it's going to get wearisome. It will be wearisome for the Buddha to keep answering these questions. So I'm going to give you a teaching where you can tell for yourself whether somebody has attained to a transcendental insight, to a transcendental insight. So whether they've attained to stream entry, which is the first level of this sort of insight, or once returning or non-returning, or arahant ship level. And he says that this teaching is the mirror of the Dharma. He calls it the mirror of the Dharma. So it's like a mirror, so you can hold it up to yourself or to somebody else and see reflected in this mirror what attainment the person has attained, yeah? What level they've attained. Or at least whether they've attained to stream entry. You can tell that level. And what the Buddha says in this teaching is that anybody who has attained to stream entry or beyond, there are four qualities, there are four things that you can say about them. And in a way, this is a test of whether they are a stream entrant or more. Yeah. And those four things, the first three of them are that they have unwavering faith in the Buddha, unwavering faith in the Dharma, unwavering faith in the Sangha. So they have unwavering faith in the three jewels. And the fourth is that they have pure, spotless, unblemished morality. so their ethical life is unblemished. So they are, if you like, the four criteria: unwavering faith in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and unblemished morality, unblemished ethical practice. So when he says unwavering faith in the Buddha, unwavering faith in the Dharma, unwavering faith in the Sangha, the Buddha then says what he means by the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and what unwavering faith in those three jewels would mean. And the words he uses are the words that we're going to study in the Tiratnavandana. Yeah? So the point is that if you could say these words with unwavering faith, then you would be a stream entrant. Yeah? A stream entrant is somebody who could say these words, the words that we're going to chant, with utter conviction, because they know them to be true. They know them. It's not just, in a way, on hearsay or even on some sort of intuitive faith. In their experience, they know these words to be true. And they're the words that we will be looking at, studying, discussing, and actually chanting, reciting in Pali. That's what we'll be doing over these four weeks. And then this fourth criteria of unblemished morality. Unblemished morality. Now, a stream entrant wouldn't necessarily be perfectly skillful all the time. A stream entrant would still, for example, not have eradicated craving or hatred. So it's not that their ethics would be perfect like a Buddha's ethics would be perfect. But they wouldn't be able to be grossly unskillful. And any unskillfulness that they... any unskillful act that they committed of body or speech or mind, they would be naturally, spontaneously compelled to acknowledge it and confess it. They wouldn't be able to hide any unskillfulness. You know how we can hide our unskillfulness. I live in a community with 8 or 9 other men, and sometimes we sort of close our doors and hide behind them, hide our sort of unskillfulness behind them, both literally and metaphorically. It's easy to do that. It's easy to do that. Well, a stream entrant wouldn't be able to, because they would have seen through egotism. They would have seen through the delusion of a fixed and separate selfhood. They would realise that this sense of a fixed and separate me, I, is actually just a deluded sense. It's not true. They wouldn't have been able to eradicate that sense of selfhood like a Buddha or an Arahant would have done. They would still have a sense of me or I, but they would have seen through the delusion of it. And so any sort of egotistical act wouldn't have much purchase on them. In a way, most of us, if we act from egotism, if we act from selfishness, we kind of think we're going to get something from that. But that wouldn't apply to a stream entrant. They'd sort of see that there's no point. What's the point? There is no fixed and separate me or you. Why act from selfishness when that just brings pain and limits our freedom? So it's because of that experience of directly knowing that there's no fixed and separate selfhood that they would be able to not only have unblemished morality in this sense, but also they would be able to have unwavering faith in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So I just want to look at the words that are used for unwavering faith, because in a way, unwavering, or at least faith, isn't a very good translation of the words that are used. So the words that are used are avecha pasedana. Avecha pasedana for unwavering faith. So avecha means this unwavering, steady, unfaulting kind of faith. But Pasadena is comes from the word pasada, and pasada is a very, very rich, even beautiful word that has lots of connotations. It has connotations, first of all, of a brightness and cleanliness, i.e. of purity, of a sort of ethical purity, a purity of mind. So pasada has connotations of purity. But it also has connotations of happiness and joy and contentment. It's sometimes talked of as having a good mind, one that's content and joyful and, happy. And serene. One of the ways that pasada is translated is serene faith. So serene in the sense that there's no agitation. There's, in a way, a sense of calm confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. There's a calm confidence that arises from a deep knowing. So there's nothing to be agitated about. In a way, it's a very relaxed quality. You can relax because you know what's true, what's real, what life is for, which way is true north, if you see what I mean. You know that, and that knowledge gives you a relaxed ease about life, a confidence in what life is about, who you are, and where to place your confidence. So it's a sort of relaxed but effortful quality, because you still want to strive to move towards the goal, but in a very, very ordinary, relaxed way, without agitation. So it's not a sort of faith where you screw your face up or clench your fists or have an argument with somebody about what's real or true or what you believe against what they believe. If you've got pasada, you don't need all of that agitation. You just know. And it's enough to know. So it's joyful, it's content, it's relaxed, it's easy, it's serene. It's also bright and pure, because there's a clarity of mind that comes with pasada. So I say all of those things because faith can be a dirty word in English. And actually what it's trying to get at is that you'd have this sort of quality, a very attractive state of mind, a very, very attractive state of mind, and it would be unshakable, unwavering, this state of mind. And it would be in relation to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So yes, a stream entrant would have unwavering faith in that sense, avecha pasadena, in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So I want to say one more thing, and then probably we'll break for tea and hand out the text after tea. So, in Bhante's language, a stream entrant is somebody who is really going for refuge, who's going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, has become real. Real because they for themselves have seen the truth of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So the refuges have become real for them. For those of us this side of stream entry, in Bhante's model, our going for refuge has yet to become real. In our Triratna Buddhist order, which is also three jewels, but Triratna. Tri is Sanskrit for three, whereas T is Pali for three. So in our Triratna Buddhist order, when somebody is ordained, it's because their going for refuge is recognized as, not as real, but as effective. So they don't have to be a stream entrant. It would be nice if they were, but they don't have to be a stream entrant in order to join the Triratna Buddhist order. So when I was ordained, I was joining an order where I was, at that time, being recognised as effectively going for refuge. And what Bante means by effective going for refuge is that somebody is able to put the ideals of Buddhism, of the three jewels, into practical effect in their lives. And they're able to live by those ideals effectively. Not perfectly, but effectively. They're able to orientate their lives by those ideals under most conditions. In a consistent, long-term kind of way. Not just when they're feeling happy. So in a consistent kind of way. So, before ordination, somebody can still be going for refuge. So those of you who aren't ordained are still going for refuge. But in the Triratna Buddhist movement, that going for refuge hasn't yet been recognised as being effective. It hasn't yet been recognised as being effective. Yeah. So you can go for refuge at all sorts of levels. But a stream entrant would be really going for refuge, and that's in a way what we're aspiring to do in our lives. Bante says that stream entry is an achievable goal in this lifetime. He says that enlightenment might seem, for many of us, for most of us, perhaps for all of us, a very, very distant prospect, something that feels almost unimaginably distant. But he says, well, stream entry is much, much, much closer to home. Much closer to home. And it's an achievable goal in this lifetime for any serious practitioner of the Dharma. If you're seriously going for refuge, consistently, over time, stream entry is an achievable goal. So again, I want to say that because these words are important. They're words that would mean something to a stream entrant, and stream entry is something that is achievable. Now, the reason that stream entry is stressed so much is because until that point, it's said that if you stop making an effort, you can slide back, a bit like a game of snakes and ladders. You can slide all the way down again into losing all the sort of progress that you've made. All the mindfulness, all the metta, all the ethical practice. If you stop making an effort, it's possible to just go back to square one. Until the point of stream entry. At stream entry, because you have a direct experience of the refuges, and that experience is sort of has penetrated your being, because that's happened, it's said that you can't fall back from that point. There's no going back. So it's said that from that point onwards, you will be assured of enlightenment, although it may take several lifetimes. It might not happen in this lifetime. It may take, well, traditionally it's up to seven lifetimes. But even if you don't really make much of an effort from that point, you will reach enlightenment. Actually, if you're a stream entrant, you couldn't but make something of an effort, because there would be such an attraction to enlightenment, to the transcendental, to the three jewels, that an effort would be a natural thing to do. Do you know what I mean? You would want to meditate. You would want to practice ethics. There would be a natural response in you. So it would be natural by then, and that's why you wouldn't fall back. So it's really important when we study the Triratnavandana that we've got this context in mind, because we're going to be reciting words that would be spoken by a stream entrant, or they would be. We're going to speak them, but a stream entrant would be able to speak them with utter conviction. With utter conviction. They'd know them to be true, whereas we may not. But we're going to study them and see if we can deepen our conviction in these words. Yeah? So we'll have a cup of tea, and then we'll start, as it were. Good. Okay, we're all in. So we'll begin. So what I'm going to do is talk for a little bit, and then I'm going to ask you to divide up into some groups where you can discuss what I've talked about, ask questions, etc., in smaller groups. So we'll have a chance to do that. Then we'll regroup as one big group, and we'll, in Pali, chant some of what we've been talking about. A bit more, probably, than what we've been talking about. So, it's double-sided. You want to start with the side with the title on, Tiratnavandana. And it starts with these three lines, Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa, which we'll explore. And then it starts saluting the Buddha jewel, the vandana to the Buddha jewel, from Ittipiso all the way down to the verse that begins Uttamangena Vandehang and finishes Buddho Tamatu Tammamam. So that's salutation to the Buddha jewel. Then from Swagato Bhagavata Dhammo is salutation to the Dharma jewel. And then over the page, Supatipanno, which is the third verse down, Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, begins the salutation to the Sangha jewel. So you've got three sections with a salutation to the Buddha, salutation to the Dharma, salutation to the Sangha, all of it prefaced by these three lines, Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddho, sambuddhassa. And when we go through it, you'll see that each of the salutations follows, each of the three salutations follows the same sort of format. So there's a verse which talks about the qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Then there'll be a verse where you express you're going for refuge to that jewel. And then there'll be a verse where you acknowledge that you're not able to consistently yet maintain you're going for refuge to that jewel, and therefore you acknowledge your shortcomings. Yeah? So each of the three salutations follows that sort of pattern. And so on the left you've got the Pali, and on the right you've got an English translation. But what I'm going to do is go through the Pali and unpack the connotations of the Pali words more so than the English translation does, so that we can explore what's of significance here and why it is so significant. So starting off with the word namo. So when we saluted the shrine, we said Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya. So Namo is often translated as salutation, or here it's translated as honour, or as homage. But actually it's much stronger than that. Namo means something much, much more emotionally strong than the word salutation or honour or homage might imply to us. Salutation can be quite a casual thing, can't it? It could be, hi there. Well, as namo has the connotation of prostrating down, your head bowing down to what is higher than you. What is higher than you? So,
is that devotion?
Yes, it's certainly got a strong mood of devotion, of gratitude, of reverence to something that's higher than you. So, in Indian culture, even to this day in Indian culture, it would be very, very normal to bow down. Prostrate even to people that you look up to. So traditionally that would include your parents and teachers, even secular teachers, you know, school teachers and so on, and of course any spiritual teachers that you have. And what you'll do traditionally, and as I say, it happens in Indian society, so I was brought up in an Indian culture, and it's still very traditional, touch, so you bow down, so you touch the feet of the person that you're showing reverence to. It's like your head, I mean, if you do the full prostration, your head would touch the feet, or be at the feet, of the person you're showing reverence to. So in this case, we would be bowing down so our head was at the feet of the Buddha. So the head is the highest, well, in Pali, it's called a limb, Angena, Uttam Angena. So Uttam is uppermost or highest. So the head is the highest limb of us, bowing down, touching the feet, the lowest limb of the Buddha. Do you see what I mean? And for us, this can feel really odd, doesn't it? It can feel, it can have all sorts of connotations that are make us really wary and uncomfortable. But in India and in Indian culture, it's not somehow unusual or odd. It's somehow a natural expression, which doesn't have the connotations of self-abasement. It doesn't have the connotations of I'm not worthy or I'm some sort of miserable sinner. You don't even lose self-respect in acknowledging that this person, or in this case the Buddha, is higher than you. It's not like you feel therefore some lowly worm. It's a healthy acknowledgement of gratitude and respect that somehow also is combined with a healthy sense of yourself. It's a very, very healthy expression all round, actually. A very positive, healthy kind of expression. For us, of course, it might have all sorts of other connotations that make it harder. But yes, traditionally, this is what you'd do. You'd bow down, you'd prostrate. So in India, when we salute the shrine, you wouldn't just be standing and then bow to the shrine. You'd actually, which is what I did at the start, you'd get on your knees and you'd touch your head to the ground in front of the shrine three times. And that would be a traditional way of greeting the Buddha. Somehow, it would be more appropriate in that it would, well, it's also, as well as an act of devotion, it's enacting receptivity. It would be saying, I'm open to your influence. Do you see what I mean? And somehow we need to be open to the Buddha's influence if we're going to be affected by the teaching. So it's a very healthy, positive sign of respect, and it's much stronger than the word salutation might imply. So you could try it if you want to. I mean, obviously, if you don't want to, but next time we salute the shrine, or later on this evening we'll be doing a puja, where you can make offerings during the puja, and people prostrate sometimes when they make an offering. Mostly they prostrate when they make an offering. That's what you do. It's no more. So yeah, namo tassa, that's salutation two. And then you've got this word bhagavato, bhagavato. And bhagava it's a word that is still used in modern Indian languages. And in modern Indian languages, it's actually sometimes used for God. So in Hindu tradition, God would be Bhagava or Bhagavan. But of course it doesn't mean that here. This is referring to an original kind of usage of the word, an original connotation of the word, So the Buddha here is being given the title Bhagava, but that doesn't mean God. Yeah? It doesn't mean God. Bhagava is a quality. It's a quality of a very, very positive quality, where there's a sort of sense that this person is auspicious. Lucky even. All sorts of good things happen to them and around them. They're fortunate, they're blessed in a way. There's sometimes, in the text, in the early text, the Buddha is said to have, his skin is said to shine like gold. He's said to be golden. His complexion is golden. And Bhagava is this quality of having a shine around you, of having this aura, if you like, this radiant aura, this brightness, this positivity, which is somehow auspicious. Even to be around it is auspicious. It brings all good fortune. So it's very, very attractive. It's a quality. You know how some people have this sort of positivity around them that makes them attractive, this sort of glow, this brightness, and you want to be in their presence. And it's not always to do with how good-looking they are physically or not, although it might be to do with that. The Buddha, for example, was said to be a very impressive, handsome man, at least in his youth. But it's not just to do with physical appearance, because some people just have this glow around them. And you want to be in their presence. And it's that quality that we're saying the Buddha had. And he had it to a huge degree, in spades, as it were. Not just like some sort of celebrity Hollywood star might have. Yeah. Subhuti, when he was talking, said it was like the X Factor, but then you have to discount whoever it is, Simon Cowell, and, you know, not that X Factor, at least not in that sense. But yes, this slightly in a way even magical quality that you want to be around, Bhagava is that quality. So you're saying, when you say Bhagavato, you're saying that yes, the Buddha had this very attractive quality. He was like this shining presence that you would be naturally drawn to. It's said in the text sometimes that even people who disagreed with the Buddha, who were angry with the Buddha, who didn't agree with his perspective, or who felt that the Buddha's teaching was wrong and maybe undermining their own status as a religious teacher, etc., etc., when they approached the Buddha, they couldn't help but feel reverence or some sort of attraction. It's like they couldn't help it, because there was such an attractive presence, this aura. And around this shrine, you've got this old golden aura that in a way represents this quality. In all images, traditional images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, archetypal Buddhas as well, you have a body aura and then you have an aura around their head. And the body aura is said to be the aura that's made from their good deeds, it's their merit, and the head aura is their wisdom aura, as it were. So you could say that this golden aura is trying to represent something of this quality, this very, very attractive quality that is Bhagava, this auspicious quality. And then you've got Arahato. So Arahang, so here Bhagava is just translated as Blessed One. You've got Arahang, Arahato. And Arahang is, it's a word that predates Buddhism. And it meant he who is worthy. Something like worthy, in the sense of worthy of worship. I mean, worship means worth-ship. Worthy of worship. From a Buddhist context, it's a special kind of worth, though. So, from a Buddhist context, the only true value is wisdom, is prajna. So in sila samadhi prajna, you have the highest thing, which is wisdom, which is seeing things as they really are, directly. So having insight into the nature of reality. The Buddha is worthy of worship because he sees things as they really are. He has prajna. He has this wisdom. And out of that wisdom flows his unbounded compassion and all his other qualities. But prajna is the, in a way, central quality that makes him worthy of worship. That's who. That's what sort of makes him enlightened. His prajna, his jnana, his insight. And his, I guess, his moral purity that flows from that insight. So arahato is somebody, here it's translated as the exalted one, but it's got the connotation of somebody who is worthy of worship, and in this sense, because of his insight, his transcendental insight. And then you've got Samma Sambuddhassa. Samma Sambuddhassa. So, Samma is an emphatic prefix. It means wholeness, it means completeness, it means thoroughness, it means, it gives intensity, it means right in the sense of true. So it's emphatic in the sense that it's emphasizing buddhasa. It's saying holy buddhasa. Buddhasa means enlightened one. So here it's translated as the fully enlightened one. But samma is this, yes, prefix meaning completely, fully, intensely, thoroughly. Yeah? And sam means much the same thing. So it's like completely squared, or completely to the power of completely. Really, really, really fully. Yeah? Completely. To the fullest possible degree that there is, to the nth degree. And buddhasa means he's a Buddha. He's a Buddha. The fully enlightened one. Sambuddhassa. So a Buddha, traditionally, is somebody not just who's fully enlightened, because many people after the Buddha became fully enlightened, just like he was. But a Buddha has, even amongst all the enlightened people, he has something more about him. The tradition is that a Buddha is somebody who discovers the way to enlightenment without any help. So there wasn't a dharmic path before. There wasn't a dharma as a path before. The Buddha discovers it afresh. So it's said that a Buddha prepares for this monumental kind of discovery over lifetimes. So the Buddha would have been practicing over lifetimes, perfecting all his qualities, so that in his final lifetime he could discover the Dharma, and not only discover it, but then communicate it to all around him. So he would open the doors to the deathless. He would discover the Dharma anew. Now, if you then become enlightened through the teaching of the Buddha, you're not a Buddha, you're an arahant. You're an arahant. This is just a distinction. You're still fully enlightened, as the Buddha is enlightened, but it's as if even the arahants looked up to the Buddha as having more than they did, somehow, or being having more qualities than they did. So when we salute the Buddha, we're saluting the Buddha in this cosmic kind of way. Not just as another enlightened being among a being among many enlightened beings, but as the one who discovered enlightenment in our age. Now, traditionally, there have been many Buddhas. What happens is that a Buddha discovers the Dharma, and then after aeons, the teaching dies out and another Buddha emerges to rediscover it. So our Buddha, we're living in the dispensation, in the age of Shakyamuni Buddha, and that would be the legend, as it were. And later Buddhism says there are Buddhas throughout space and time, the past, the present, the future, everywhere. There are these beings. So the Buddha is in a class of beings called Buddhas, and they are discoverers of the Dharma. They have this cosmic significance of uncovering the Dharma. And that's who we're going for refuge to when we say these words. It's not just enlightenment, it's this Buddha as a Buddha in this special sense, as a special function. So Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. And then, so that's repeated three times, and then the first line, and we're going to then stop there, is Ittipi So Bhagava Arahang Samha Sambuddho. So Ittipi So just means it is so, it is true, this is it, as it were. So what you're saying is another sort of emphatic. Such indeed is how it's translated here. Such indeed is he. And then you've got the words Bhagava, Arahang, Samma, Sambuddho again, which mean, as I say, this auspicious, glorious, X-factor quality, this one who is worthy of worship because of his wisdom, his transcendental insight into the way things truly are. And who is fully and perfectly awake, who is a real, who is a Buddha, in this full sense of the word, they're a Buddha. So in a way, that's just the first couple of lines of this Tiratnavandana. And we're paying homage to that. And we're opening up to the Buddha as a Buddha. Next week we'll explore some of the remaining lines. We'll see if we can get more than two done next week, where we look at other qualities of the Buddha, and those qualities will help explain, in a way, who the Buddha is. But what I thought we'd do now is break up into groups and just see if you want to discuss or have any questions. There'll be some people from the team in each group. And you may have questions or you may just have thoughts on things that I've said so far. It's just a chance to explore that. We'll do that for about 15 minutes.